Bank of America settles a big lawsuit involving racial discrimination.
Just how widespread was it leading up to the mortgage crisis?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill, and for Steve Chiatakis, you're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, December 22nd.
Coming up, what's next for Europe after yesterday's mass lending spree by the central bank?
We'll hear from a town where the businesses are cutting prices just to be nice.
And Mexico has a new tourist attraction, the end of the world.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
We'll start with the $335 million that Bank of America has agreed to pay to settle allegations involving racial discrimination at Countrywide. That was the giant mortgage lender that B of A bought back in 2008, and it's been accused of steering more than 200,000 Black and Hispanic borrowers into high-cost subprime loans. For more, let's bring in Harvard housing economist Nicholas Retsinas. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Countrywide is not the only lender that's been accused of using racial discrimination when handing out mortgages. How widespread was this?
I think, sadly, it probably was pretty widespread. You have to remember, at the time of the bubble, there was desperation on the part of borrowers. There was push marketing on the part of lenders. And that's a recipe that can, unfortunately, lead to the kind of discrimination that the suit yesterday talked about.
Well, how could this have happened on such a large scale? Weren't the regulators watching this?
Well, I think in the first decade of the 21st century, there was an ideology that said that the market would be the best way to allocate credit. The market would be the best way to allocate resources. So, yes, regulators were looking at these issues, but they weren't looking at it in a way that was trying to intervene with the government. They were trying to stay out of the way. And sometimes the best argument for a regulated market is an unregulated market. And I think in large measure, that's what we saw.
Do you think this kind of thing has come to a halt now?
Oh, I think in large measure, you know, I'd like to say we have no vestiges of discrimination left. I think that would be by far an overstatement. But we have much different standards today, much different regulation, much tighter credit screens. And I think because of that, you're not likely to see the kind of widespread discrimination that this story talks about.
Nicholas Retsinas, a housing economist at Harvard, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Well, the case at hand involves Countrywide, as Jeremy said, and as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, for B of A, Countrywide is the acquisition that just keeps on taking and taking and taking.
Start with that $335 million mortgage discrimination settlement. It's just a drop in the bucket of B of A's total cost of taking over Countrywide at the height of the financial crisis. First, B of A paid $4 billion to buy the huge subprime lender. Then add $20 billion or so in settlements with investors who bought Countrywide's toxic mortgage securities. The bank has given $8 billion to states for their loan modification programs to help struggling homeowners, and it's bled another $13 billion in losses on its mortgage business since 2008. The total tally, at least $40 billion. So why did B of A buy Countrywide in the first place? I asked Eric Oja, banking analyst at Standard & Poor's.
Bank of America wanted the Countrywide mortgage origination network, which in hindsight was not the greatest idea. But at the time, it was assumed that the subprime exposure could easily be handled.
Oja says now B of A's only options are to keep settling and paying out billions or put Countrywide into bankruptcy. He says that's the nuclear option, but it's too costly and risky for the bank to contemplate. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The government said this morning that the number of people applying for unemployment benefits dropped again last week to 364,000. That's the lowest level in 3.5 years. And that's where we'll start with Diane Swonk, chief economist with Mesirow Financial. She's with us from Chicago, as she is every Thursday. Good morning.
Good morning.
So 3 weeks in a row of good job numbers and the lowest level in 3.5 years. Is the job market finally getting better?
Well, we're seeing firing abating, which is good news, especially right before Christmas, because employers tend to let people go at the end of the year. So that's the good news. The bad news is the reason those numbers are also coming off is those who are on long-term extensions to unemployment, they've run out and they just can't apply anymore.
And unemployment benefits are tied up into this whole payroll tax fight in Washington, whether they're going to be extended. You tend to know what's going to happen in these down-to-the-wire Washington battles. So what's going to happen?
Well, I'm hoping that Congress has a very short holiday vacation and they're called back by the end of the year next week, in fact, to finish up the business they left unfinished before the end of the year.
That both the House and the Senate will come back, you think?
They're both going to have to come back to vote this through and get us into a situation where we don't have to deal with the tax hike at the start of 2012.
Finally, Diane, this is the last week we'll be able to talk to you in 2011. You're going to be off next week, hopefully enjoying some holiday time. What do you think is the big economic story of 2011?
You know, never in my career have I had to be as much of a political strategist as an economist to figure out what's going to happen next, and never has the decision of political leaders, or lack thereof, meant so much for the economy. So I feel like I'm standing on a fault line that's shifting every day, trying to forecast the economy based on the whims of leaders both here and abroad.
Diane Swonk, chief economist with Mesirow Financial, thanks as always, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
To say that 2011 was a hot and dry one in Texas is a bit of an understatement. It was the worst one-year drought on record for the Lone Star State. And as Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, it's had devastating consequences for Texas woodlands.
The numbers are stunning, even to officials at the Texas Forest Service who did the survey. Analyst Chris Edgar estimates this year's scorcher wiped out 100 to 500 million trees, from ash junipers to loblolly pines.
To put that into perspective, that's about 2 to 10% of the total number of trees that we have in the state on forest land.
In East Texas, the drought's wreaking havoc on the timber business. It's already lost nearly $1 billion from the wildfires alone. Industry consultant Bob Harper says tree plantation owners now have a tough decision to make to invest in replanting or not.
A lot of people are having to decide, do I want to take the risk? And the forecasts we're hearing are that this drought's going to be at least another 5 or 6 months before anything happens favorable.
This past summer, Texas suffered the hottest 3 months in a row ever reported in American history. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Now to the Marketplace Global Perspective. The European Central Bank's program to lend to banks is officially a hit. More than 500 banks snatched up almost $640 billion by the end of the day yesterday. But what looks to be a major success now may end up looking more like a modest win in the future against the mounting debt crisis in the Eurozone. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
Investors and analysts have generally applauded the move. The injection of so much cash seems certain to end the credit crunch in Europe. Banks may now be more willing and able to lend to each other, and this makes a major banking collapse much less likely. But Bob Parker of Credit Suisse says, though welcome, this latest measure is limited.
This may provide short-term relief for the liquidity of the banks, but obviously it goes nowhere in solving the very fundamental problems of European governments like Italy and Spain.
Because the banks that borrow this $600 billion may not be keen on lending it to the likes of Italy and Spain. That's what the European Central Bank is hoping they'll do, but analysts say the banks have already lost a bundle on Eurozone government bonds and they won't want to buy any more. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Well, in Italy this morning, the Senate approved a $33 billion package of budget cuts and tax increases. In Spain, the new government is proposing spending cuts of $20 billion for the next year. But the big focus today for the people of Spain is the annual Christmas lottery, with a total prize value of $3.2 billion. It's the biggest lottery in the world, and thousands of winners are being announced today. The BBC's Guy Hedgeco reports from Madrid.
It's known as El Gordo, which literally means the fat one, because the prize money is so huge. And this year, despite being in the grip of the Eurozone debt crisis, four out of every five Spaniards were estimated to have bought a ticket. In fact, lottery organisers have estimated that people spent even more this year on tickets than last year, an average of just over $90 per person. But playing the lottery might not just be a sign of economic desperation. Roberto Garvia is a Spanish sociologist who has researched lottery behaviour. He says playing El Gordo is also a social activity.
People mostly play lottery to do something with their friends, in the same way that they go together to watch a soccer game.
Today's winners won't have to work again, but for most Spaniards, times after El Gordo will still be tough. In Madrid, I'm the BBC's Guy Hedgeco for Marketplace.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said...
Every Thursday, we touch base with the polling firm Gallup to find out what Americans are thinking about economic issues. Today, we thought we'd focus on the payroll tax cut, the most recent victim of Washington, D.C.'s squabbling. If lawmakers can't come to an agreement by the end of the year, taxes for working Americans will go up. Frank Newport is Gallup's editor-in-chief, and he's with us now. Good morning, Frank.
Hey, good morning.
So what do we know about American support for the payroll tax cut?
Well, you know, there hasn't been a lot of polling on that recently, but there have been a couple of polls that were done by the Associated Press and by the National Journal over the last month or so, and both of them showed exactly the same thing. 58% said they supported the idea of extending the payroll tax cut, and about a third said that they opposed it. So on available evidence, it looks like the American public would say yes to the idea of extending the payroll tax cut.
And what about how people will spend that money and its impact on the economy?
Well, you know, that's an excellent question, and economists disagree on that. We don't have a lot of survey research, you know, what would you do with an extra $40 a week and what have you. Economists debate. Some of them say this would be great for the economy. Some say it wouldn't make much difference. We do know Americans actually, on average, think that the amount of taxes they pay is about right. So I'm not sure that it's going to make a huge difference as far as the average American is concerned.
And what's the current fight in Washington, D.C. mean for consumer confidence?
Well, it's potentially very negative for consumer confidence. And the reason I say that is back in August, July and August, when we had the big debate over the debt ceiling, we saw consumer confidence drop almost 20 points on our Gallup measure. So we are predicting that it possibly could do the same thing right now, which is bad news because consumers have actually been getting somewhat more positive. We've seen an upward slope on that, positive slope. We'll wait and see. But based on what we've seen before, this may not be good for consumer confidence, which in turn, of course, wouldn't be good for the economy.
Frank Newport is Gallup's editor-in-chief. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Well, Jeremy, it turns out the border fence set up between Mexico and the United States is blocking the path of migrating bears.
Aww.
Yeah, in the cartoon version of this in my head, little mice are like scrambling under the fence and then making raspberry sounds mockingly at these guys. That's probably not happening.
Poor bears.
But according to the New York Times, researchers say the black bear population is being threatened by the barriers. They didn't leave any comments on the fence's effectiveness at keeping illegal immigrants out.
If you've been to the mall in the last few days, you've probably noticed a lot of sales, and you always have to wonder who's getting the better end of the deal, you, the consumer, or them, the seller. But in the small town of Pittsboro, North Carolina, the sales are most certainly for real, like at the C.A. Sullivan Music Shop. Here's reporter Lita Hartman.
And watch this. This is a little trick you can do on the guitar. First finger on the fifth string. Seventh fret.
Tony Sullivan is showing 14-year-old Sean Jackson how to play a jazzy version of Greensleeves.
Dang, just blew my mind.
Sean travels an hour and pays $25 to learn from a master. Sullivan used to be a session musician in Nashville and toured with his own band. Now at 61, he sells guitars in this little North Carolina town and teaches kids how to play. Since the recession hit, he's been giving some lessons for free.
And I'm a lousy businessman. I mean, everybody that comes in that door is more or less a friend, and I can't help but treat people like that, you know, unless they do something to change it, you know.
At one point, Sullivan had 8 kids learning for free. Now it's down to 3. Some of the parents can't afford the gas anymore.
They're my neighbors, and, you know, and they're hurting.
Things have been slow for him, too. Nowadays, people come in to sell their own instruments, not to buy any. But that hasn't made him change.
I'm old enough, and I'm from the South, and working class people. Integrity was a big deal. I mean, that was the only thing you knew you could take to the grave with you.
Those values aren't gone. At the end of his lesson, Sean Jackson slips Sullivan an extra $5. Sullivan catches it and hands it back. But he does take a gift from his landlady, Elizabeth Anderson.
And so I said, well, why don't you just take $100 off the rent for a while? I could use the $100 too, but not as much as this store could.
Anderson figures if she can help one business stay afloat, the whole town will be better off. In Pittsboro, North Carolina, I'm Lita Hartman for Marketplace.
So this time of year always brings these best of lists, you know, the top 10 album of the year, Adrian, or the most important people of the year, or the best radio shows of the year, whatever it happens to be, stuff like
that. I'm a fan of those lists. And today in our Midday Extra, we ask, why do we love the end of the year lists so much? Here to talk with us in studio is Sasha Strauss, Managing Director at Innovation Protocol. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, what's going on?
So a list of our own. How about the top reasons people love lists?
Wow. All right. Put me on the spot. I'd say first and foremost is because we're accustomed to numerics. I mean, we've been growing up and Jeremy, when you failed the spelling bee, remember those days, right? You got third place.
Jeremy just never failed
the spelling bee. That's just the way that it is. It's just that we use numerics to sort of measure things in our lives. And by the way, numbers are a universal language. Right? One means the same in all countries and all vernaculars. So it's kind of a thing that we can all default to.
And are there more best of lists nowadays with any website with, you know, its weight in viewers can come up with their own best of list and get a lot of traction around the internet?
That's the beauty of the internet is that we can be very, very specific about who we're communicating to. So there are lists, as you would assume, for everything. And because it costs nothing to publish them on the internet, I mean, just in getting ready for this conversation, I looked up a few interesting ones. For example, top 10 actors that used to be porn stars or facepalm moments, you know, things of that effect.
And are the lists that we're seeing on the internet, on these websites, are they for real? Is there any statistical analysis behind it or is it just made up?
You know, I have to tell you that I'm frustrated with the answer because, for example, Google has made it to the top brand list of all times. I mean, in the last 10 years, we remember hearing about Google being number one or number two. 80-some-odd% of the world has never even seen the internet. How is it that Google is the number two brand? You know what I'm saying?
It seems like every year we start getting these lists in December earlier
yes.
and earlier. Is that true? Is that really happening?
Yeah, I got the November list this year. You know, I was kind of astonished. It sort of interrupted my Thanksgiving. And again, it's because it's so inexpensive to create things on the internet that anyone who thinks that they have a say about any particular topic can create a list. And just as Jeremy said, there is no qualification. There's no auditing institution on top 10 lists.
And what's in it for the people who are making these lists, who are sitting drawing these things up?
Content, baby. That's what the internet's all about, right? All we want is new information to consume, and if they can sell ads adjacent to that content, it's a good business.
What do we get out of it as viewers of those lists?
Well, the thing about it is that it makes it so simple for us to make choices. And I know that sounds a little crazy. We as consumers believe that we like to make new decisions every day, but we don't. You all drink the same type of coffee. You take the same route to work. What these lists enable you to do, though, is that there's a new topic that you're about to consume, you know, top 10 gifts of the year, et cetera. It puts it in an order that is so simple for you to process that it actually becomes quite easy for you. Say to yourself, well, an expert did the auditing for me. They helped me recognize that these are the top 3 gifts for children this year, and therefore you sort of relax. You feel like someone's enabling your decision.
And what's in it for the people who actually wind up on the list? So say there was a best radio host of 2011 and Jeremy.
And you were right on the top of it, yes.
Jeremy wound up on the top of that list. What's in it for him?
Well, the best part about it is that's just an ego stroke. I mean, in the end, right? But the truth of the matter is that it really depends on what is adjacent to the top 10 list. For example, where it lands. Does it land on Inc.? Or does it land on some no-name website that no one's ever heard of? And in the end, that could be used as a sort of a stature measure. If you were the top 10 radio hosts in the world, obviously just by that criteria alone, people would assume that you have a significance.
Unless Jeremy's mom made the list. And
that's which right. She does.
Which she does. She has a website, top10radiohost.com. But
wow.
Let me ask you one more question. Is there any list that you have seen this year that actually told you something that you thought, wow, that is interesting?
Yeah, you know, we're all social media-fied. It's kind of crazy at the moment. So someone actually put together top 10 lists from Facebook for, you know, top 10 brands on Facebook per category. But then they have it for music or any of the other sectors. And I thought that was – this was really fascinating to me. Do you guys know who the number two celebrity on Facebook is?
I know that Britney Spears is number one on Google+.
On Google+. Plus.
Yeah. Google+, right. Plus, right?
But
you won't discuss
on
that.
Facebook, what, Bieber? Or he must be number one.
Keep going, brother. How about Vin Diesel is number two?
Really?
Vin Diesel? Huh. Who knew? Who knew, right?
Yeah.
Right. That's why it's astonishing. And again, what data is used to compile these lists doesn't really matter. What matters most is that we were excited to talk about it.
Well, you definitely make our top 10 guests in the studio of the year for the Midday Update. So thank you so much, Sasha Strauss, Managing Director at Innovation Protocol.
Pleasure to be with you.
Thanks.
And finally, Adrian, to Mexico, which is trying to get people to look past the drug-related violence that has dominated media coverage and come visit the country again.
Yeah.
Come be a tourist, see the sights, have a margarita or two.
Sounds nice.
Maybe three. Well, according to Advertising Age, tourism officials are promoting an odd attraction.
Which is?
The end of the world. They want you to come down and see the end of the world, which according to the Mayan calendar could come next December. Come down to Mayan country. One hotel in the area proclaims, quote, "The Mayan calendar is running out, and so is your chance to win big."
Sounds like a good reason to go to me. Yeah, yeah. And there's margaritas.
Better hurry. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrian Hill. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.